This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hello, halflings! It's me, Jasper William Cartwright, and I am joined today by...
Leander Unati Lewis Nyao, but everybody calls me Unati.
And...
Jeremy Cobb, but Connie from Transplaner calls me Cheremy. As in Cher, C-H-A-I-R-E-M-Y.
That one has like a full origin story as well, which the people will never know.
I honestly have completely forgotten the origin story.
It was because you were talking about the chair you were sat on at the time.
You're right.
Yeah.
Now so the people know the backstory.
Well, kind of. They don't know what it is about the chair specifically that was brought up in conversation.
That's true. That'll stay secret forever.
God.
This is the wrong dungeon and the wrong dragon.
Full prince vibe? Woof.
This makes them even more black.
Cake glitches and pitches.
And lands in the cusp of a teaspoon.
Oh, no.
On a nat 20.
No.
You think this is just a game?
That's disgusting and I love it.
Yeah. We're about to get into something real big now. We have an extra special guest with us today. He is the host and editor of the Dungeon Masters block, DM Nastics, and the producer of Whelmed, the Young Justice Files, Neil Powell. Welcome to Three Black Halflings. How are you?
I'm good. I feel remiss to, because I don't think I mentioned it when we had all of you on the Dungeon Masters block, but my tagline is often DM Neil, a.k.a. Jote Moniak, jack of all trades, master of none, IAC. So that's my handle on Twitter, and I just use it everywhere. So
nice.
Very
good. Smooth,
very,
you know?
So good.
Tantalizing.
Whenever I get to the end of the show and I start plugging our stuff and where you can find us, I'm always like, you can maybe find me at JW Cartwright.
I think on your show, I was like, don't follow me.
Honestly, I feel like part of that, I feel like that's become our brand, the fact that none of us have smooth self-promos.
Yeah.
Our self-promotes in here with
I'm going to back this truck of self-promotion up. Oh.
Like, my Insta's just vegan recipes and like me cooking and shit.
Well, I mean, as true as that is, but that is a well-oiled machine, and the one that I like more is that I am a bigger fan of other promotion. Like, I would just as soon spend whatever time you give me to talk about other things that other people did. So if you force me, I will definitely talk about myself, but oftentimes, even if I have a guest, which you all kind of felt, I'll talk you up. Like, if you're on, I'm going to talk you up. So that's the way I go.
Yes, spread the light, gas your people out.
That's the Neil Powell promise, folks. The Neil Powell promise.
The Neil Powell promise. I love that. Well, if you ever want to come and do sort out all of our self-promo and how we should promote ourselves, then just let us know.
If you want to, like, help me get out of bed in the morning, you know what I mean? Like, do my laundry and, like, you should be like, yo, Nazi, you did that thing. You washed your socks today. Big up to you. I'd really appreciate that.
My go-to way of doing that, I learned from a very early age from my uncle. He would come, I'd be dead asleep. He would run into the room, yank off all the covers and shout, get up and pee, the world's on fire. And you're just like, what?
I love that.
Well, it's so shocking that you immediately pee before getting up.
Yeah. That's why he took the covers off. He's only wants to do so much laundry in a day.
Reminds me of my grandma.
Once he sees that you start
peeing,
he just picks you up and runs you into the bathroom.
Well, where, to where the fire is. I'm assuming that his answer was lying.
The fire. Yeah, just
like there's a fire, Jeremy.
Like, focus.
Hope it's not an electrical fire. So anyway,
this chance is going to make it a lot worse.
We should get to the actual.
Yes. Neil.
Neil Firehose Powell.
Done. So Neil, we always, whenever we have guests on the show, we always like to ask them about their origin story for how they got into Dungeons and Dragons. Was it like a calling from an early age, or did you come to it slightly later in your life? How did you get into this amazing game, and how did it get hooks in you?
Yeah, so
it seems to do that to a lot of people.
It certainly wasn't yesterday. So a friend of my mom's, her husband, obviously was a little bit older, and I was about 10 years old, and they just didn't have kids, so I was kind of like that second home, and he had been playing for a while, and so at this point it's well over 20 years ago. I don't like the math we're doing, but that's fine. So at this point I guess it's 25 years ago, but basically he introduced me to second edition in an interesting way. So it was the Sinister Secrets of Saltmarsh module, and he made a whole party for me to play as, and then helped me, because then it was like, here's all kind of a quick smattering of all of your options, and I'm helping you through what's speaking to you as a character, and like the different options, then ran me in a solo campaign with just one character and one DM, eventually inviting me to his home campaign. And the full circle of that story is that I DM him and his brother, and now they're adult sons at my table.
Whoa, that's really cool.
That's so awesome.
I'm not crying you up.
There's so many cool things about that. I really like the idea of teaching you how to play the game by having you play a bunch of characters at once of different classes. Because it gives you like a quick crash course on the ins and outs of the different classes and sometimes some of the races and stuff. And then it's just really cool to hear that it's come full circle like that.
Yeah, and so we didn't play. I mean, there was definitely a big span of time where we weren't in games together. But then, like I said, it finally circled back around, and then we were all together, and then they're like, we were playing and their sons weren't old enough. And then eventually they were. And so that's the table that I'm at now.
The dungeon student has become the dungeon master.
Indeed.
Yes. I love that. And I really enjoy the idea, like Jeremy was saying, of like introducing you in that way, purely because as well, it stops having those like misconceptions. I feel like everyone, when you first sit down, you read and you go, oh, rogue. Okay, this is what a rogue has to be. Yeah. I like the idea that you just kind of meet it almost like a bit mechanically and just like, what do I find more fun?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because then I think that you removes that thing of like, oh, clerics are always rubbish. We're actually in D&D, they're one of the best classes because they've purposely tried to make it not rubbish and just like the healer of the group, you know? So like you get to experience the fun of being a cleric without being like, oh no, clerics suck, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I think about how much easier that concept is now, because if I think about trying to do it in, so I was brought in during second edition, like that effort on the part of the DM is much higher, and then even in third edition, what if I thought about doing it right now, I could just go grab the starter set and just have the person play all of them. They're printed, they're ready. Like, here's the whole crew, give them names and let's go and let's see what ends up being what you enjoy the most.
Yeah.
Nice.
Because second edition was a lot crunchier, wasn't it? And even third edition, both of them were much crunchier.
Yeah. Thaco, when your armor class goes down.
And people would weep when you attempted to grapple. Just because it was, you had to bring out several volumes of rules to figure out how to.
Grappling. That was like the amount of guests that have like mentioned grappling in second edition, then shuddered on the Zoom. Yeah. I'm glad I've never met this before.
We had to pause several interviews so that the guests could take a quick breather after the mere mention of grappling.
Pull themselves towards themselves, you know.
Yes.
So I guess my question then is sort of, how does it go from being this love, this like kind of family thing, into like more of a public sphere, into these shows that you work on? At what point did you realize this is more than just like a fun hobby, but something that you really genuinely want to like do and bring out into the world? Because I think that's always an interesting step for people to take.
Yeah. So the So it didn't actually start with me. So that makes my origin story with the Dungeon Masters blog a little bit more interesting, because it started with Mitch and Chris and an iPhone, because back in the heady days of 6 years ago, in a lot of ways, it's a similar origin story to how you all started, because I know you searched for Black people doing this sort of thing, like, but it wasn't there, which is just nuts. But back then, it was nobody was really doing it. There were a few podcasts that had been around for hundreds and hundreds of episodes. I mean, and now it's just like you accidentally stumble into an actual play just because you were outside and someone's handing it to you. Yeah. And so it's that sort of thing now. But back about in 2015, when we were very first starting, that was kind of the thing. There wasn't that many shows. And Mitch and Chris had realized these are the conversations we're having anyways. Why are we not necessarily recording them and putting them out? So one of the things I've learned about this fandom, and one of the things I promote the most, is to be actively engaged. And so that's what my origin story is. I observed what they were doing. I really liked how they were doing it. And I just openly asked and said, how can I be involved? How can I help you? And it wasn't here's how I can help you. It's how can I help you? Yeah. So of course they made me edit.
Acts of service are important, but then you land up cutting the damn thing.
So that's where it all started. And then what my intro further in was the idea of DMnastics, the gym where dungeon masters can work out their mind. So basically it was taking the original episodes and finding like a small actionable exercise that someone could do with that information. So if it was like, The Magic of Magic is one series we have where we look at things from Magic the Gathering and add them to D&D. And so then it's taking that next step of like going to, like we have a forum, grabbing random cards, putting them on there, saying make something. And so then it was, that's what DMnastic is in compared to the DM's block. It's a like legitimate step-by-step exercise, go through this. And like I said, lift the mental weights.
That's super cool. I'm going to do that with my housemates because I have no idea what they want to do with anything, like with their characters, nothing. I've got a whole bunch of Magic the Gathering cards. I'm going to be like, here you go. Pick the one that speaks to the most. Now, this is how you can make it work.
and it's such an interesting exercise. I mean, so I bought a pack of Magic cards for no other purpose than that last night for about $5. And so, and the joy of that is also like, I don't know what I'm going to get. So literally I'll open that booster pack and let's see what happens. So again, That's that inspiration of DMnastics.
I have some Magic the Gathering cards, which I'm going to go open right after we record this.
Yeah, like I opened mine the second they arrived.
I've been
Jasper.
Sat there for so long, and I've had no. I was like, man, well, I will. And then I'm like, oh,
they're
cool.
So sick. There's like incredible stuff in there. That's like I'm going to take that. Thank you very much for that tidbit, Neil. I am going to use that.
Well, yeah, and even because you could open it up and you could be like, that's my character, like, and you didn't know that until literally the second before you see whatever that is. And
representation matters. You're just like I could plug that in there.
You're like inspired by the art and like the name and the abilities of the card in particular.
Everything about it. And so then even certain aspects, and it's developed more over time from published WotC material. I mean, they're literally in the same building. So then you're having those worlds come out as published things. But then even going back to older sets, seeing how those mechanics work, and then, integrating those further into your D&D game.
That's super cool. Okay. Thank you.
That's very cool.
So I'm going to take some notes.
So Dungeon Master's block is a little bit more, I guess, ideological and theoretical, just from having, I guess, listened to it and taught and been on it, but listen to you guys talk about it. It seems to be more of like you're talking about, for instance, I listened this week, among several, to the TPK episode that you did recently, where you're talking about how to deal with TPKs, in some cases to use TPKs to your advantage, different ways of kind of spinning the TPK, where it's like, it's more, Unati is having a full breakdown right now.
Yes.
If you're wondering why Jeremy's struggling not to laugh, it's because Unati is covering her mouth and unable to
leaned fully away from her microphone.
Because I'm stuck in a really like sticky TPK situation. And I don't know how to get out.
Unati, you need to listen to the episode.
I will. Thank you. Sorry, continue, Jeremy.
But
my bad.
How did you work your way up from editor to eventually co-host?
Yeah, so that so the original DMnastics was a segment within the episode. So basically, it was a 5 to 10 minute segment that would specifically reference back to a previous episode that would then be in a later episode. So, like, you know, just for simple numbers, saying episode 75, DMnastics would come on and be like, "Hey, I was inspired by episode 50 about magic cards. Here's how you could use those in a game, step by step." So it was that approach, eventually spinning out into its own thing, and then me being a more regular host after kind of that integration of DMnastics to being on the Dungeon Masters block.
Okay. That's nice. Okay. So it's kind of like if Stephen Colbert, instead of spinning off for his own show, had become co-host of The Daily Show back in the day. Like, you started out as a segment and then graduated to being co-host.
Yep.
So I actually wanted to ask, because since the DMnastics is so much more about, like, practical, how do you put this together? How do you, like, mechanically draw this out from, like, different sources and developing those aspects? And Dungeon Master's Block seems to be kind of a mix of, like, mechanical stuff, but especially creative elements that you can improve and develop as a Dungeon Master. As a DM yourself, what's your approach? Because I know some people go in like very numbers heavy, very crunchy. They maybe run like a lot of dungeon crawls, or maybe, you know, straight like classic D&D quest type stuff. Some people go in more for like the combat light RP heavy. Some people go in for like the collaborative storytelling element. How would you describe your DM approach?
So my home game, it ends up being a lot more mechanical, because those are the same people that brought me up in second edition through third edition. There was another edition, and we're playing fifth edition. And I also played for a really long time in the Emerald Spire, which is a super dungeon in Pathfinder. So we actually went over to Pathfinder for quite a while. So it ends up being pretty crunchy, but I do, knowing that that's what a lot of my table likes. And so then I do also make really concerted efforts to say, okay, but what is your background? I'll make that my job to integrate those things as we go along and other things come up at the table. When it's not, and it's usually for streamed games, I usually end up straying pretty far away from mechanics to stay more agile in those moments, because then there's no... It's not, I mean, you're on a stream. I can't be like, "Hey, cool. Yeah. I need to air quote go to the bathroom because I don't know what's happening anymore. I really just need to look a bunch of stuff up online." And so I end up moving away. But so I ran a stream that was all focused on being inside of Undermountain. And that ended up one of being, while it was there and I did have mechanics on hand, it ended up being one of the most RP heavy, amazing games that I've ever played. So that's basically kind of my home versus one shot or stream.
Nice. Okay. I wonder if I could piggyback actually a little bit on that question, Jeremy, because I'm a massive home brewer, and I've been doing a lot more recently in terms of actually like reskinning things and like putting things mechanically into game that aren't quite there, or, you know, taking something and changing it a little bit. Like, what's your approach? What would be your advice, I guess, to listeners who maybe are trepidatious about like adding in homebrew elements because they're worried about breaking the world or overpowering something, underpowering something? That kind of thing. So obviously you do a lot of that, especially in DMnastics, and I'm just interested, what would be your approach or advice on that one?
I think the biggest piece of advice is they're right. So it's going to happen. And so you need to be okay with that up front and have ideas on how to undo that in those moments. Because one of the biggest things, and I don't know where that piece of advice came from, but oftentimes I'll look at it like health points. So let's say it's 10d10. That theoretically means, in a worst case scenario, that monster has 10 hit points, and in the best case scenario has 100 hit points. Technically, all of those answers are right, because it's all the power of the dice. And so figuring out what that looks like, and then just changing it in that moment and having those dials to turn. And another big one is figuring out advantage and for speaking specifically to 5e, the other dials that I always have ready to turn are advantage and disadvantage, and whether or not someone has proficiency. Because that swings things in a really big direction. If I were to say you have disadvantage and you don't have proficiency versus you do have advantage and you can use your proficiency bonus, That swing is really big in either direction. And you're the reason that there can be environmentally advantages and disadvantages at any moment. Like, because you can introduce rocks fall, everyone dies. Or rocks fall and everyone has difficult terrain. And so now that disadvantage is applied.
That's awesome. I'd never thought of the idea of environmentally, if something was not working or, you know, being too underpowered or too overpowered, then sort of chucking in something that could then, like you said, very simply, with it being damage dice or advantage, disadvantages. That's something that's so easy to like do on the fly as opposed to just panicking and being like, I'm going to kill all my players. Yeah. Oh, this is my big bad and they're getting smoked real hard.
Yeah, like, no, and that's absolutely right. Like, and that, like, because I tend to sort of like struggle with that. Like RP like world, like I'm in my element. But when it comes to like balancing those encounters, I'm like, I don't want to go too big, I don't want to like underplay it, but like also understanding that your environment is also something that you're playing is really, really useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that absolutely. Well, I mean, even lower, we had talked about it on the episode that you were all on, that the idea is also, I think we, I don't know, maybe there's not a nice way. I think people are too beholden to like higher level monsters having layer actions and legendary actions. Like, a layer, I mean, a layer, it sounds so ominous, but it's like, that's just where the person lives. Like, you're in my house. Like, that's how the layer works. So a first level creature has every right or reason to have layer actions if that's where you're encountering them.
And
so that's another thing you could introduce, because it just happens on turn order 20. So there's no reason why you can't just halfway through the battle introduce a layer action because you're in their environment.
Yeah.
And also there's no reason that even if it's like a chicken, there's still going to be one, you know, a chicken that's stronger than the rest of the chickens. Therefore, it's a legendary chicken. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, please don't talk about chickens. I'm still trying to find all the damn chickens in Legends of Zelda, Legends of Zelda. Like, I can't. I'm one last damn chicken. It's been a year.
Now I want to play in a game where you're a fox infiltrating a chicken coop.
And you come up against legendary chickens.
Yeah, legendary chickens. And also the chicken lair. Like, the chicken gets lair actions. Like, chicken gets lair actions. Into your face and everything, the area is obscured.
Those claws, man. Those claws. And it stinks. Those claws are deadly. It stinks. It makes you want to fucking chunder. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, sorry. It makes you want to slightly chunder. Please cut out my cursing.
No, they should remain. It shall remain.
We're adding it to the intro. I also wanted to say, in terms of the HP thing, that is an idea that I have used before, because in the very first game that I ever ran, the big bad, like, the players had stomped through most of the first few encounters, in large part because I let one of the players, the barbarian, min-max, so that he started with maximum strength and 19 constitution. So he's just an absolute monster at level one. He started with, like, I think he started with 16 or 17 hit points. It was crazy. But in the final one, I was like, oh no, the bad guy's going down too soon. So I start just increasing the number of hit points, not to some insane amount, but it's like, I set myself a rough parameter. I'm not going to go over this amount, but let's make this an actually challenging encounter. And the idea of, like, Schrodinger's hit points, where it's as strong or as weak within these parameters as I need it to be.
Yeah.
Until it actually happens, I think is a really useful tool. I've heard it sometimes criticized as like bad DMing, but honestly, if under the circumstances, as long as you're not just like,
being an absolute like asshole. Because I think, like, I mean, like, I'm terrible at math, but I kind of do that instinctively. Like, if I notice that, like, this is not going to be satisfying narratively for my players.
Yes.
Like, if they get through this in, like, the next three rounds, it's not going to be satisfying for all of the build-up. There will be no payoff. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of like, I'm going to make it last another three rounds. So then I'll adjust the HP. Because then by the time it gets there, then they're, like, really good. I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. Now this is fine. This is fine. Cool. And if they beat me at that point, sweet, you know? And I just kind of do that organically. So that's kind of useful to understand that from, like, a technical, mechanical point of view. Mm-hmm. Because I don't know why I DM, because I hate numbers. I can't count.
But I think, Neil, though, like, I think you nailed it, and I it's something that I really enjoy. I love it when, as a player, when the bad guy gets down to half hit points and suddenly starts pulling out some extra bells and whistles. I think that's, like, the best moment. It's like the kind of, oh no. Like, oh, we in it now. Like, you know what I mean? When suddenly lair actions start happening and the DM's like, they're looking worried and a bit concerned. So they're kind of, like, less concerned with their own safety. So they start, like, pulling rocks down, and you know what I mean? There's, like, I think that's it definitely can work narratively for that, like, kind of half hit point thing. And I think that could really work.
Yeah. And I think the other thing I was thinking is that, because I've had a scenario where my group absolutely destroyed Big Bad, but I didn't change how fast that happened because it wasn't the dice deciding, it was them deciding. They spent the extra effort, all the extra time, all of this preparation that basically they stacked all of their resources into the heavy hitter. You know, if you think about it large, you think about like True Strike and all these things, and it just went, and then the bad guy just disappeared, and I was like,
crumbled.
Well done.
Fair enough.
Yes, but like I said, if it's that dice swinging in a way where it's I'm rolling all ones, they're rolling all 20s, there is that element, like Unati, you're mentioning it doesn't feel great.
Sometimes it does feel great, like when Jeremy's rolling all ones in Wagadu.
I live for that. Or when he realizes it's somebody has bonus action aggressive, and he's like, "What? Sorry,
in a situation like that, I think it works because the setup to it, you guys always go into the battle being like, "Oh no," and like terrified, and then becomes really funny when I'm just rolling threes for like six rounds and just getting destroyed.
The best thing about Wagadu is that you know it gets bad for you as a DM when your sorcerer is just improvising with his staff, just taking opportunity attacks to bop them on the head and killing them. Like, that's when it gets real embarrassing.
That show is a parade of womps. Just me getting womped over and over.
Thank you for bonus action aggressive. Thank you so much. Thank you for realizing how that works, Onati. I thank myself. I'm going to take a Snoop Dogg moment, and I just want to thank myself for realizing that I could bonus action.
I wanted to say also, I totally agree with you, Neil, that if it's a situation where the players have just straight out played really well, then you're just rewarding them for being good. Like, you're just being like, dude, you guys did this awesomely.
Yeah.
I was in a game once where we did that, and the DM increased the opponent from like 120 to over 300 hit points.
Nope. That's not fair.
I get
where the DM was coming from. It was part of it was that we'd had a really good plan, and also part of it was that, like, I think I critted, like, we all surprised the bad guy, and then I critted with like a third level inflict wounds, and so dropped like 10d10 or something on him in the first round, and then also the paladin critted on like a third level smite or second level smite.
Oh my word.
It was brutal. And that was how we did that much damage, but still, you just gotta let it happen.
I'd be interested, Neil, I'd be interested to know, what's your opinion of doing it the other way? Like, if you're reading a room and like and it's like not necessarily that they're in a TPK situation, so therefore something narratively interesting might happen, but it's like they're gonna win, but it's getting a bit crunchy, or it's getting, do you know what I mean? Like, I wonder if you've ever encountered that. I feel like I have, like, once or twice. What would be your thought on that? Like, if you feel like it's getting a bit crunchy, this isn't narratively going to be really interesting if they all get killed by a bunch of, like, I don't know, quicklings or, like, you know what I mean? Like,
or even that the result is inevitable. You know they're going to win. Why are we waiting another six rounds time to get this over?
Yeah, so... yes, so to speak back to Jeremy's point, sometimes people don't agree with these mentalities, and I'm okay with that. If that's the way you want to run your table, and you truly do want to just straight up let the dice decide, that's great. I don't. I do exactly what you're saying. And so the idea is also, like, if it gets to that point, I try and determine if there is a way to have any level of narrative payoff with, like, let's say the death of this monster. And so then you kind of get into potentially the idea of, like, is there somebody that maybe isn't getting the spotlight as often enough this session or this game? Because again, if we're in that range and it's not like the most I can get out of it is like giving the, basically kind of giving the kill to a certain person, why not? Like, what? Like, there's no reason not to, because, like you said, it's inevitable. They're clearly going to win. No one's having as much fun because they also realize it's inevitable. But determining, like, is there any at all narrative piece of, like, oh, these are the same monsters that took my village. Well, like, let's let that character do it. Like, why not? Or, again, like, going back to someone that hasn't had as much spotlight this session and going with the classic Matt Mercer, how do you want to do it?
This HeadGum Podcast is brought to you by Aura Frames.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers. Aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Aura Frame.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, well.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Aura Frame, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HEADGUM at checkout to save.
HEADGUM. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt.
Mm-hmm.
So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that there is a lot of scenarios where I think you as a DM have to, well, you realize that you are the DM, right? You are the dungeon master. You are in full control of this world. And therefore, if there is a moment for something narratively that would be so sweet, but maybe it's ever so slightly against what the dice have said, or maybe you haven't got it in your extensive notes, like, that's so fine.
Yeah.
Because ultimately you're there to tell a story. And like we've said multiple times, trust the dice, because the dice are like the best storytelling component that you could add, because it will always enrich you and bring something new. But I think in that scenario, you're absolutely right that you can do that. And also advice for players. I've heard this a few times recently in shows I've listened to, where like players get a bit more like inventive about the way they might describe something. So like, say the DM says, Jeremy, how do you want to do this, whatever, and but Neil, this is the monster that's wronged your family. I've heard players recently kind of be like, I hand my sword to Neil.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I think like that's
awesome.
For me, like as a DM, I'm like, that's kick-ass.
Yeah.
Like you should, like I would encourage all players to realize you have the agency to do that. As long as your DM, I mean, if you're at the end of a fight, it could get a little sticky if you're like midway through a fight and that person's the other side of the thing or whatever. Do you know what I mean? But generally, I feel like
cool.
As a DM, I would definitely let that moment happen.
Yeah, no, for sure. Because I think I had, like, by way of example, I had a similar thing at sort of my table, and in that one of my players like had picked a character that they didn't really like eventually mechanically, and so we figured out how to like kill them out of the game without the other players at the table knowing, and then they all kind of tried to save him. but it was epic. Like, it was absolutely epic. Like, I timed it out. Like, I made it happen at a distance. I knew they would all stay. It would take several rounds. Like, it kind of all worked, and then he was killed. and came back as like a death cleric. And then once they all managed to kill the big bad, and so the game I sort of run is like this colonial world where what would happen if the ancestors had intervened. And I remember there was one line that sort of came to me in the moment where I was channeling my inner racist, where I'd said, I will stab you like the, I will gut you like the sow that you are. And I knew that I was running the game, New Bethesda, like she was dead. Like this Chang Chang had just killed her. Like that amount of hit points would have done it. But I knew that Chen was next on the initiative order. So I just held off and I was like, how do you want to do this? And it became this beautiful like moment of like retribution and like ending the thing that the party really, really enjoyed. Like, I mean, she had like what? 3 hit points left. Like I could have just called at them. I was like, no, come on. Like you get to have this moment. It's for you. And then he said, I will gut you like the sow that you are. And it was just epic because he remembered the line and it was just like beautiful. Ooh. With his character, like God of War music playing in the background. It was stunning. And I was like, yes,
yes,
we did it.
Yes.
So I think cool. Like if things can happen narratively like that, totally allow it. But that's just me also excusing the fact that I cannot count.
Yeah, your Nazi's got to get out of jail free card because she might just not have calculated it right. So maybe,
but narratively, it was fucking beautiful.
She's just going by how it feels, folks. She's just going by how it feels. How many hit points? Yeah. I don't know. However many it feels appropriate.
It feels appropriate. Yeah.
You did 14. That sounds like a lot of damage. We'll say it started looking hurt. Neil, you had said well throughout this, I think one thing that you kept bringing back is that the fact that you try and tailor your DMing to the players. And I was curious, I don't know what your tables are like diversity wise, but I'm curious in terms of trying to like tailor things to your players, how you approach like diversity in terms of whether you have a diverse group of players at the table, or whether you're bringing in, like, drawing from different cultures that D&D maybe doesn't focus on as much, things like that, introducing those into your games, diverse cultures, peoples, etc. How do you approach that from your DMing?
Yeah.
From a DMing point of view, that is.
Contextually, because we're in a podcast setting, I am paper white. So we'll start there. And so just for a quick frame of reference. And so one of the biggest things I would say from every aspect is that, and this is going to be very simplistic, but I mean it with as much weight as possible, is that words have meanings.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, and they can mean different things for different people. So like, it's super important. It sounds very simple. And in a lot of ways, it sounds almost like cliche and dumb. But no, like words have meanings. So I think one of the biggest things about approaching diversity is finding the right word about those cultures that I look at. Because I think one of the biggest go-to words is, how are they different? And I think that's always the wrong question to ask. Because my question is, how are they awesome? Like, or what about this group? What about this culture? What about this individual makes them awesome? Why are they there? Like, I mean, as simple as that is, like, that's the right question I need to be asking about why they're being introduced into my game or at my table.
Yeah, why are they awesome enough to be involved in your fantasy realm, this incredible, awesome place that you've made? Why have you picked these specific people? Yeah. That's so beautiful, man. Like, that's really, like, such a great way of putting it that I've never, like, encountered before. And I'm now annoyed at myself. I caught with this. God damn it.
How are they same, same, but different?
I'm going to steal it, but I will credit you every time.
Perfect. But yeah, so that's my biggest thing. And so then contextually, like, no, I don't have a very diverse table of people that are playing at my table. So I also have a relatively large table. I can't do math either. I don't know. So sometimes people show up, sometimes they
don't.
Yeah, so I have six players.
2 is 5.
Yeah, six players, including myself. That was the problem. I'm like, I count, right? I am a person. Yeah, I'm a person at the table. So yes, there's seven people around the table, and then I have two POC at the table, but they're all men. And so there's that aspect as well. But again, my biggest thing is, why am I introducing this person, this culture, or anything at the table. Mm. There needs to be a reason, and I need to know what that reason is. So,
I'm ululating very badly, because if I ululate into this mic, I will literally blow into the red. The listeners will be like, oh, why?
Legit, though, this is an actual concern, though, when you're playing on Zoom, like, a lot. Like, there are times where I really want to, like, properly, you know, scream. Yeah. And then I tend to get a message from Jade, our amazing producer, being like, hey, just a touch quieter if you can. Like, everyone in the building can hear you describing how this dragon is getting slain right now.
So I am in my flat. Okay, cool.
Yeah, okay, awesome. Yes, I am actually in my flat and not on the field.
So in terms of the published materials as well, because obviously we've talked about on the fact on the show that sometimes some of the stuff is in the published materials carries over some, I guess the best phrase would be some backwards ideologies that have maybe not been fully interrogated. Not to say that anything's intentional, but like I know that one of the big sticking points for a lot of people is the half-orc race, mm-hmm. and how like the evolution. I mean, talk about second edition. I know how they were originally described, I think, in first edition as coming about, and how that has evolved over time. But even still, there's still some issues there. How do you approach those elements of the game as well? Not just in terms of introducing the characters, but also taking stuff that's in the game itself that may not be as welcoming to people of diverse backgrounds of any kind.
Yeah, and I think that I've also been investing a lot of thought into this. One of the biggest things is also like any amount of answering this question is research that I need to do. Like first and foremost, like these aren't things that you need to add, like trying to put the onus on like you as the DM, like this is the research you need to be doing, like as a person, like not just asking, because I mean, there is a scenario where like, I could just ask all of you, like, what should I be doing? Like, that's not the right. Agreed. So that's not the right approach, because like, even that is so focused of like, that's you trying to answer that for me. Like, what is the point of that?
It's not my responsibility to educate you.
Yeah, and so,
I've got my own shit to do. Please leave me alone. Hydrated, moisturized, and minding my own business. I'm sorry. Please continue.
So, but that's the biggest thing. And also, like, I think the way you, I'm trying to figure out the exact wording that you would use, but like, it hasn't been interrogated, because you also see, even just from a mechanical perspective, things that have lasted that shouldn't be there. If you look at things that have ties back to what is the alignment, and it only works for this person with this certain alignment. If those things just from a raw mechanical perspective haven't been removed, then the level of nuance that is involved with this conversation probably hasn't been interrogated to the depth that it needs to be. So then I think that's also the question that I ask of myself. I need to ask of the published material is why is that person? Why is that culture? Why is it there? And if I don't like the answer, that's the joy of being the DM. You change it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think especially when it comes to, content that feels, especially like the mechanical stuff really kind of irks me as well, because I think that's where it gets a bit tricky for people. And I think that's something we've talked about a lot on this show, is trying to enable people or kind of embolden people to feel like they can change those things, because that's always the one that I think gets me, where people feel like, oh, but it's in the books, and that's like, it's just that they get a minus to this to their intelligence, or do you know what I mean, something like this. And you just and so I feel like it's really good advice, because it is very important, especially when it comes to that mechanical stuff, where you kind of go like, there is no real reason that should hang around, or that should be a thing, you know?
It's been really great doing the show, because really, like, for me, like, as a DM, there's been, like, a real marked journey just by virtue of doing the show and engaging with more, like, creators and, like, makers and Jeremy and Jasper, like, kind of, like, taking that onus and going, D&D has given me a guide. And that's all it is a guide. Like, it's not gospel. Like, it's
okay. It's the pirate code.
You know what I mean?
Like,
you know, like, yes. Gygax is not going to come and smite me from above if I change something. It's okay.
But if he does, I'm going to be ready, because it turns out I'm a fifth level barbarian, so I'm going to rage, taking half exactly. damage. You know what I mean? I'm going to be mechanically ready to fight you, Gygax.
Yeah. That was really well put.
Yeah, all of that to say, like, the published material has problems. Like, you and again, I've listened to everything, and I'm going back through and catching up on the actual play, of course. But the conversation you previously had about just contextually, like, there are problems, because I think going back to, like, even the first thing that I said, words have meaning. I think it's not... Some of that hasn't been approached in that way.
I think it's a slight attitude thing, which I think is shifting in the public lexicon as opposed to just like in our community as well. The idea that words have meanings, I think for a lot of people, there was when a lot of change has happened since, you know, like early sort of 2000s, 2010s kind of onwards, the idea that words have meaning, the ideas that words can really change people's lives, affect it on a very fundamental level, the way we approach words in society, etc. And I think that we're just starting to get to that point now as a community where we're realizing, oh, like if I continue to repeat the same stereotypes in my home games with my group of friends, I'm going to perpetuate this thing that I actually like, you know, because I think it's, you know, it's always one of the things that's hardest to do when you're in a close group of friends and there's people make jokes about something and you kind of feel like, I don't feel comfortable calling that out, or I don't feel comfortable kind of addressing that. But like D&D genuinely is something where you can help to mold the way that we approach these things. You can change the sort of the way that you talk and the way that you approach things. D&D's been helping me getting over my getting used to using they them pronouns and things like that. Do you know what I mean? So it's a very real, there's very real world tangible things that you can do just by altering the lexicon you use within the game.
And I think on that, Jasper, as well, I think, like you say, Neil, like words have power, but I think like the further extension as well from that is that one, like you're talking about, you know, people becoming more aware, what's starting to happen is like releasing that process of like it feels like a personal attack and just understanding that your unconscious bias has power. Like you need to like and I have it. I have unconscious bias. We all do. So like, I need to kind of like sit down and go, hang on, how am I not seeing this? I'm seeing this through this lived experience, through this lens, through this trauma brain, through this whatever. And somebody is coming to me and saying, hey, you're missing something. I can choose violence and go, you're attacking me. Or I can choose peace of mind and go, hang on a moment. There's maybe something I haven't considered here. And just be a chill dude, you know? Just be chill. Yep. And learn from that experience and grow and be better. That is what growth is, right?
On the subject, because you mentioned alignments as something that can, especially when they're associated with specific races and so on and so forth, it's been really interesting playing Wagadu, where alignments really aren't an issue. And in fact, morality itself is it's defined as being very gray in the book itself. It talks about how, nothing is necessarily entirely good or bad. It's a matter of perspective, and it's basically a completely different framework of morality, because in contrast to Dungeons and Dragons, it's drawing from, I guess, a more African moral framework, whereas D&D, though it is officially religiously unaffiliated, I think it's fair to say, is ultimately drawing from a Judeo-Christian framework in morality.
Paladins.
Which brings me to my other question.
Well, yes.
Which is
nice segue, Jeremy. Nice segue. You should
really
do this more often.
Really smooth.
Thank you. I have been riding a segue through this entire conversation.
That's why Jeremy's been quiet.
Yeah, my background is actually not, this is not my real room. I'm outside. Yeah. I get segue through this whole conversation. So, Neil, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are, in fact, a person of faith, as am I, specifically the Christian faith. And I really wanted to, because this is something that I almost never hear discussed in any context. But how do you, as a person of faith, approach D&D, considering its very messy history and in some cases messy present with religions? This is not just Christianity, but I know there are people of other religions. Like, I've seen posts from Muslim people talking about how certain things in D&D make them uncomfortable and so on and so forth. How do you, as a person of faith, approach the game and those elements of the game that might normally be considered problematic?
Yeah, and so to add a little bit more context, both Mitch and Chris are currently, their employment is as youth pastors at Christian churches. And additionally, the person that originally got me into D&D, at the time he was an ordained minister, and his go-to catchphrase was like, "I could marry and bury you." I'm like, that's super weird. I don't know why you tell people that.
Marry and bury me?
These are huge life events.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I'm too young for either
of them.
How
much time is passing between...
Same day, baby. Same day.
Wow.
Maybe not even in that order.
Whoa. Oh, yeah. It's Friday. It's Friday, yes. Folks.
Well, I think the biggest thing is like to one say that, like, yeah, there are definitely countless past issues and probably countless current issues with the way that the term I kind of like using is the way that structured religion approaches certain things. I think it will always keep going back to the fact that words have meaning. But if they're not choosing to interrogate what they're trying to, in some aspects, condemn when it is related to D&D, then I don't understand what. Because if you're not asking the right questions, like, why do you already have the answers? So the idea of that D&D is all of this, but I'm just like, but you know nothing about it. So, and that's not also to say that in certain areas at certain tables, they're right. Like, I can make D&D vile. If that's what everyone's agreed to, then that's the table that I'm at. And I can, because it's all about the people at your table, it should feel safe. That's not to say that they won't feel uncomfortable, because part of that is part of the game, but they should always feel safe at your table. And if your table is safe with a lot of body horror and things like that, then that's the game that they want to play. In the same way that there's no reason that a Muslim person couldn't play the most fulfilling game of D&D, because you're making it safe and you're asking those right questions of what are their lines and veils for them. In the same way that, like I said, I remember a story of the person that got me into it. They were at a home game and someone was playing a wizard, and they came to the table and they had a physical spell book that they were like opened up and were like reading out basically incantations. And so that's the, yeah.
Oh, hell
yeah. Yeah. So
no.
That's
So
the culmination of that story was them basically saying, "You're a rogue now." Because they weren't comfortable with that at their table. Like, the person just showed up out of the blue, literally, like, opened a book and for that player basically said that I can't cast my spells if I don't do this. And
okay, well then, sir, you cannot.
Looks like you can't cast.
Yeah, you can't cast spells. You can't be in my house.
Sorry.
Because I don't need anything coming. I don't know what you believe in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If someone playing a warlock turns up with a Ouija board, you don't have to leave my house. I'm gonna leave my house. I don't want to be anywhere.
Guys, my vial of pig's blood have arrived. No. I pulled out a huge bucket.
Get out.
Yeah.
Sir, you
just
can
in time for
get,
the game. Yeah. Who we resurrected? Yeah.
You can get all the way out. You can get out of the state. You can get out of my WhatsApp group. You can get out of my Facebook. Block, 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 and the block out of my life.
But I guess if that's at the same time, if that's the game that you want to be playing, like you said, you know, if that's the game that you're playing at your table, I think
absolutely
it comes down to a conversation. And what it sounds like you're saying is that really that D&D is a framework. It's not as prescriptive as people sometimes consider it to be. So those elements that could be problematic could easily be reskinned, because at their core, they're just a frame on which to hang stuff. You don't have to call if you are in a religion that makes you uncomfortable with dealing with like infernal stuff, fiendish stuff, anything to do with demons or devils or hell or the abyss or anything like that. You can easily just reskin it or just not include it in the game.
Descent of Avernus no longer exists. Bah!
I think the core is that it has to be a conversation between the people at the table, what they're comfortable with. I guess if you're a group of like Wiccans playing D&D, you might want to include more stuff to do with like calling on the forces of nature and so on and so forth. And maybe you do want to be casting spells at your table. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
The other thing I think about is like even looking at like a religion is does the religion in that D&D setting, is that something that makes the person uncomfortable? Mm. Because there's no reason why I can't just take the stack of deities and go squish, and now I have a D&D setting that is monotheistic. Like, done. Like, it's different aspects of the one god that is in the setting that I play. Okay?
Yeah.
I think something that's making me realize as well is that to an extent, we've discussed this many times where the downside that we feel like that's currently happening with a lot of additions and a lot of things that come out that are still problematic and that aren't being dealt with is that the people that make the game don't give you enough tools, don't sort of show people enough how to remove those problematic elements or change them or help people feel safer at tables, etc. Not necessarily that they can't be. It's like they're not encouraged to do so enough. They have to kind of go out of their way, listen to shows, you know, watch videos, etc. on how to do that. And the reason I say that is because I wonder whether, speaking in this context, especially when you've got, say... a game which, several classes deal very intrinsically with religion within game, etc. It's making me realize that actually the likelihood is that you're probably never going to get to a point where Dungeons & Dragons is going to be A-okay for everyone. But purely on the basis that, like, you know, if you're dealing with a religion of any kind, there will almost certainly be counter ideals, etc. But what it's making me think is like actually exactly what you're saying there, Neil, is that if the way that they framed it, if the way they brought you the material and said like, hey, here's the guidebook, do you know what I mean? Here's the thing, and then just very easily gave you like a, if you want to remove this stuff, here's how to do it. If you want to remove this stuff, this is how you do it. If you want to change something, this is how you do it. Like, that's where I feel like the real issue for me is they don't give you the kind of tools to very easily rework something or very easily change something so that you feel almost like it makes it feel like the onus is on you, and I feel like the onus should still be on like the makers of the game to give you those things.
I think even unspoken that onus is there, whether or not WotC realizes it or not. Something that I've come to a lighter version of this conversation, but come to the same realization, is that certain people won't do certain things unless they're in like an official WotC published material. And I'm like, wait, what? Yeah. But why? Yeah. You're why? In charge. You do you. Like, but
yeah.
The Cleave rule just helps.
Yeah, but some people don't feel empowered to do certain things and use certain rules until they've seen it in an officially published WotC material.
Exactly.
And so that to speak to that, to say that onus ends up being there because that's how some people feel, is that they won't do it until they see it in a book.
Yeah, and that's absolutely where it feels like for me. It feels so important then that Wizards of the Coast then do more, because you know, I think that there was we did a whole episode on like Tasha's, for instance, where they introduced like why they introduced the changing of ability scores, etc. But it was like, it was still kind of like, and I think in there was a thing about dealing with kind of like dealing with other cultures or you know, but it was like half a page, and it's like, well, okay, I think we can bring more front and center these things to allow people the owners to enrich your game. You know,
a whole book.
Yeah, yeah. You could easily fill a whole
volumes,
book
in
with,
fact, you know, with pictures. I will do the audiobook for free.
No, whoa,
actually,
no,
not for free. My minimum rate is My minimum rate is £250 an hour. Thank you very much.
Another finger has bent down.
Contact my agent.
Yanati has decided to leave Three Black Halflings because she is now doing the audiobook for all published Wizards of the Coast material, so she's going to be busy
but
for a
little while.
Hey,
not seeing sunlight.
Just a minute.
I guess with that, one thing that we always like to do on the show, every time we have a guest, is to get a tale from the table, Neil. That is a fun, crazy, chaotic, dramatic story that has happened in-game to you or someone else at a table that you've been at. The more chaotic, the better. Neil, do you have a tale from a table?
Oh, you can make me cry, too. I've been loving those.
We do enjoy tragic or heartwarming cry stories are also welcome.
I mean, I can. It's not my tale to tell, but it's been told to me. So, I mean, if you really want to make you cry, I can. Like that.
Okay. Don't know why I just said that.
Perfect. So this is a tale from a table as told to me by Ed Greenwood, because we did have him on a while ago, and he is at this point just real world Elminster. But he said one of the most impactful things, and I think this speaks well to what D&D has always had the potential to be, but the wrong people have gotten in the way of that at times. So that's to say that this is an older story of a convention where you have, I mean, I am very stereotypical when it comes to what bad D&D can physically look like. But a lot of neckbeards, if you will, were at a table and a 9-year-old girl sat down at their table to play. They said, absolutely, we have an open seat. Go ahead, come sit with us and enjoy the game. And so she played a paladin and she was going, and the parents had stepped off to another piece of the convention. And so they're playing. And basically you have very similar to a Hodor moment. And this 9-year-old has been so engrossed in the game and knows that this is what her character would do. And she decides to sacrifice her paladin character, knowing that it's the right thing to do for her and her character so that the rest of the party can survive. And what ends up happening is that she's like basically bawling, crying at this table because it's so emotional for her. And the parents are like, oh my gosh, what did you do to our daughter? And literally this group of white neckbeard people are like cheering her on, physically and emotionally lifting her up for the choice that she's made. And that's what D&D is.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's what D&D that's what D&D has always had the chance to be, and the wrong people get in the way at times.
I'm done.
Yeah.
I can't. That one's actually done me in.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's so adorable.
That was a really good story. Yeah. That was a strong tale.
That was a great tale from the table. Yeah.
It's yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I love that. Wholesome tales from the table is now like a thing.
It's so true. That is absolutely what the game could be at its best. 100%. That's really cool.
That
it's such a and you know, I've said on this show before about the fact that in a very physical way that our memories and our imagination are in the same part of our brain, so that when you're imagining a D&D game, it goes in the same place as your memories. And I think about that 9-year-old girl, that's like a full memory for her.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like she fully remembers that moment, and I just think it's just that's incredibly powerful. Like I remember when I was I remember more imaginative stuff. Yes, that'll do.
You are correct.
From my childhood than I do like real stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like I remember because I was always a kid that was off in fairyland somewhere. Do you know what I mean? Like imagining something running through the woods playing Star Wars or you know whatever with my friends. And like it's so impactful, it's so powerful, and I think that you know you're absolutely right. I think for those white neck beard neck guys, as you just said, like what a moment to like recapture some of that kind of just like youthful, imaginative joy. Do you know what I mean? And what an amazing story. Wow,
I bend the knee to that girl.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Unati has now pledged her service.
Yes.
she has my soul. If she ever needs someone to go to war, I'm there.
Yeah. Is it the Lady Mormont? Is that who it is?
Oh yeah, Lyanna Mormont.
Lyanna Mormont. That's what it was. Yeah. So Lyanna Mormont. Like in my head now, that girl grew up to be Lyanna Mormont.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. That'd be so awesome.
I bet she's a badass right now. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's what I did too.
She's just out here doing things, changing the world, because I think that like D&D can give you that impetus. And if you learn those life skills at that young age, like, oh man, sorry, I'm like, I've got goosebumps. Like, that's amazing.
Sixth edition, there's going to be a female head writer. We're all like, yeah, absolutely. And it's like the best, least problematic edition. Everyone's happy. It's just all great. Wow, Neil, thank you so much for coming on. This has been so amazing. Like, you've just been dropping little truth bombs all over this, this episode. I'm going to go re-listen to it.
He just carpet bombed us with truth.
Nothing but facts. Did he lie, though?
It was great. So Neil, please tell the listeners, the halflings, where they can find more of your stuff, where they can get you on the internet and consume more of these incredible truth tidbit bombs.
Definitely. So if you go to your podcatcher of choice, which my brain always thinks like of a literal like person catching pods for me, with a net and everything. Yes. So you can definitely search Dungeon Masters Block or DM-Nastics. And then, of course, the one that we didn't really talk about, but if you happen to like Young Justice, a cartoon that is coming back for a fourth season, that's the other podcast that I do. So Whelmed at the Young Justice Files. Twitter handles would be at DMS_block or at DMNastics. And for me personally, that's again at Jote Moniak, Jack of all trades, master of none, IAC.
Love it. Thank you so much for coming on, Neil. And thank you, halflings. Obviously, you can find us as always on the internet. You can follow us on social medias at TB Halflings. We also have our Patreon as well, which is patreon.com/TB Halflings, where you can get more TBH goodness. And I think that's about everything for this week. So thank you so much for listening. And we will see you very, very soon. So long, Shire folk.
So long, Shire folk.
Meow. Keep on dungeon mastering.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.